I want you to look at the text, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1 to 3, because we're going to talk about starting in the wrong places to find the answers. And to introduce that, I want you to look at Hebrews chapter 12, where there you have this rather long sentence that is involved. And by the way, when you get to verse 3, there's a comma that ends at verse 3. It does not end in verse 3. It just goes on and on and on. What does Hebrews chapter 1 say? You remember when you took English grammar for the first time? They talked about finding the subject and finding the verb. And you'd have to, a part of the test was find the simple sermon, find the simple verb. Now, on the screen, if you'll look at it, I've given you some clue as to what the simple subject is and to what the simple verb is. You know what Hebrews chapter 1 says? It says, God has spoken. And that's really where we're headed in relationship to this lesson. But let me tell you of an incident that happened in my life when I was a very, very young preacher. I think I was 18. I was the first time I'd ever preached every Sunday at the same congregation and arrived down and preached outside of Lewisburg, Tennessee, really excited. And there was a man that was there whose wife was a very faithful member. I went to visit him one Sunday afternoon. And he said, and his opening remark to me, I don't believe in God, because God let that mule kick my 7-year-old brother, 8-year-old brother, and kill him. There can be no God. I can answer that a whole lot better than I could then. I'm not even sure what I said then. But I want to suggest to you, that man was starting in the wrong place to find the answer. That's what this lesson is all about. Instead of getting back to what is the fundamental beginning place, they start over in this place out here, and they said, because of a mule, I will not believe in God. Starting in the wrong place. The same thing whenever there's other kinds of suffering. There are individuals who really struggle about the matter of little babies dying. How can there be a God? And here's where they start, because little babies die. I know you and I have a different view of the eternal destiny of a little baby and all that baby avoids in the matter of death. I'm not denying the pain and the hurt and all that is involved in it, but instead of starting where they began, they start way out over here and said, a little baby was shot in some drive-by shooting. Therefore, there cannot be a God. Starting in the wrong place to find the answer. I cannot believe in God, somebody else says, because God would never let anybody burn eternally in hell. And so individuals said, there cannot be a God, because there is no, God would not ever send anybody to hell. It's rather interesting, by the way, that in our world we have taken the very nature of God and changed the nature of God. And so there are those who've been trying to answer this very question about somebody being in hell eternally. All over here, change the very nature of God and deny the very existence of hell. Starting in the wrong place to find the answers. There cannot be a God, because I know some Christians that hurt my feelings one time. There really cannot be a God, because I know some individuals who claim to be Christians. And they're way over here, and they make a determination as to whether there is a God or not because of the actions of some hypocrite in the church. At least that's the way they view those individuals. They start at the wrong place to try to find the answers. People say, well, I picked up the Bible to read it one time, and I've just got so confused there cannot be a God because I cannot understand the Bible. They likely have not read that much of the Bible, but they arrive at the conclusion there is no God. Why? Because when I get in the book of Revelation, I just cannot possibly ever understand anything about it. Therefore, there must not be a God. Starting in the wrong place to try to find the right answer. And then there are those individuals who talk about the way they are. They've got anger within them, and God made them anger. They're covetous, and God made me to be a covetous person, or some other action in their life. And God made me this way. I didn't choose to have anger. I didn't choose to be of this nature. And God made me this way. Therefore, there cannot be a God. Starting on the wrong side to try to find the answer. And then there cannot be a God because I cannot, and then you fill in the blank there. I put the word drink there because if there were a God, I'd be allowed to live any way I want to. I'm not going to sin real big, but I'll lie a little bit, I'll drink a little bit, I'll do a little bit of this, I'll do a little bit of that. And if you're trying to tell me that God is going to condemn me for there being a little bit of this and a little bit of that in my life, there must not be a God, or I have to change the very nature of God. Could I pause long enough to make this observation that those who change the nature of God by such argumentation have themselves elevated themselves above God? I want you to think that through. There is someone that is supreme on this earth, and it's not God, it is me, and therefore I know more than God, I'm greater than God, and therefore I have become my own God in relationship to this. I want to suggest to you 5 beginning questions in trying to find answers. Here we are trying to discover what God wants us to do and how we ought to live. Pardon me. Fundamentally, we understand there are 5 questions that we need to ask before we really begin this journey. Number 1, is there really a God? And by definition, I mean, as you think about who God is and the very definition of God, there is a pecking order in our society. You do kill spiders, do you not? Why? You're bigger than spiders. You do at least try to kill snakes, do you not? Yes. You do, and you come all the way up the ladder, and you could start down with insects and keep going all, and right up here at the top of all of this, in that view of mankind, in the evolutionary view, the supreme right up here is a human. Is there something greater than that? If there's no one greater than a human. If there's, pardon me, if there's no one greater than us, if there is no supreme being, then you can live any way you want to. All of those problems that we presented a moment ago are really not problems at all, because there is no answer. And if there were an answer, you would be able to find it. But if there's no God, go out, and as the Epicureans say, let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's a Greek philosophy, the Epicurean philosophy. They're mentioned by name in Acts chapter 17, and they were the Greek philosophers who struggled with all of this, and their conclusion is, you're going to die, so enjoy today and make sure you enjoy this day more than you've ever enjoyed any day on this earth. And that's all right if there is no God. Secondly, if there is a God, has He revealed Himself? There might be a God. But if God is some force that is there in this world, something greater than the universe, something that was there in the beginning, and He has not revealed Himself, whatever we said about answering the first question applies right here. If God has not revealed Himself, deism says God created the world perhaps and wound it up like a clock, and now God's folded His hands and sitting in heaven just to see what kind of mess we're going to make out of it. He's not going to help us at all. Deism says, well, there is a God, but He's not involved at all in any way on this earth, and He really has not involved Himself. If there is a God, if there is that eternal force, that eternal life, if there is that eternal one, and He has not revealed Himself, then the Epicureans are right. Let us eat, drink, and be merry. Let us live any way we want to. Some of those things we talked about a moment ago about I don't believe in God because. If there is a God and He hasn't revealed Himself, let us eat, drink, and be merry. Because there's no guidance in this world. The third question is, has He revealed Himself in such a way that I can know He exists? What if one had to be able to speak fluently seven languages and have PhDs and all of these many degrees to be able to understand? What if the revelation of God and the Bible were so complex that nobody would ever even be able to read it and have any understanding of it? I read the Bible once and I couldn't understand it. What if we could not read the very language it was written in? What if God has not revealed Himself in a way that I can understand Him? Maybe I'm not smart enough. Maybe I'm not rich enough. Maybe I'm not educated enough. But if God, there is a God and He has revealed Himself in a way that I cannot understand it, let us eat, drink, and be merry. Because there's no way we could ever find out how He wants us to live. He might exist. He may have revealed Himself, but He has not revealed Himself in a way that I can understand Him. The fourth question we need to ask, has He revealed Himself in such a way that I can understand what He wants me to do? He could have revealed Himself and shown His power and let us know that there is a God, and in that way have revealed Himself. But has God revealed Himself in words that I can understand? Has God given me any direction about what He wants me to do? Maybe the deists are right. Maybe there is a God. Maybe He has revealed Himself to some, but He hasn't revealed Himself to me in a way that I could ever comprehend what the Creator of this world wanted me to do. Now, having said that, if there is a God, how has God revealed Himself? That's the force of this lesson. Just so you'll be able to understand where we're headed in relationship to this, I want you to understand that God has revealed Himself, and we shall show the evidence of that in just a moment. God has revealed Himself in three ways. God has revealed Himself to me so that I can understand there is a God. In the first place, I suggest to you that there is a God who has revealed Himself because, and ignore the fact that these words are from Psalms 19, and think of the force of them. The heavens declare the glory of God. You look at the creation. You look at the world. You look at all of that that is around us and come to a realization that there's some glorious force in this world that absolutely overwhelms me. Has He revealed Himself? He has revealed Himself in all that surrounds us, the universe that is around us. Acts chapter 14, Paul talks to those pagan, those idolaters in his land, or in the area where he was preaching. And he said, in times past, God allowed the nations to walk any way they wanted to. Nevertheless, He did not leave Himself without witness, in that He gave them fruitful season and good things in their lives. Go back to Psalms 19 one more time. The heavens declare His glory, and the firmament, not that which is distant, way, way out, but that which is near to us. The firmament shows His hands at work. That's what the word handiwork means. You look at what's happening in the world and look at all that there is. You look at the matter of planting a seed and what happens to that seed when it's placed in the ground. What force is there that brings all of that about? And then the statement in Psalms 19 is, without a Bible, listen to this, don't ever believe that the only reason you believe there is a God is because somebody taught you what the Bible said. Psalms 19 says, there's no language on this earth in the thousands of different dialects, subsets of languages, recognized grouping of languages, there is no dialect on this earth where the voice of the heavens is not heard. And the next verse says, and it was heard yesterday, and it'll be heard today, and it'll be heard tomorrow. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night after night shows knowledge. You ever look at the stars? Have you been able to observe that comet that is now visible in the evening after the sun sets? An amazing manifestation of something that's greater than we are, some force there is in this world. You and I need to understand that. I remember going to the Parthenon in, not the one in Athens, Greece, but the one in Nashville, Tennessee. I was a student at Lipscomb. Down in the basement, they displayed paintings. Listen to this. I walked through that door, and there was a painting on the wall, and I was sort of on the left side of that painting, and I looked at that painting. It was an amazing painting. The rays of that sun were shining right at me. I walked to the middle of the room, and guess what? The rays of that sun, instead of shining over there to the left, were shining right at me. I walked over to the right side of that painting, and guess what? The rays in that painting of the sun were shining directly at me, and I couldn't believe it. I went back, I made the trip a second time, and I thought, wow, there must be some really, really talented painter who can make that sunlight appear that it's coming right at me. The very rays are shining right at me. There must be some great painter. But is that true? Is that just an accidental thing that happened? Now listen to the consequences of that. If it takes some great painter to paint the portrait of a sunset, what does it take to make the sunset? The heavens declare the glory of God. You see, the creation of God shows design, does it not? Everything that shows design means there is a designer. I stand here and I look at the pews all arranged here. Do you know every pew in this building is exactly the same number of inches from the every other pew in this building as far as front to back? That remarkable? Wonder how that happened. I stand here and I see straight lines. They're all lined up straight. And here's this aisle over here. And it's a perfect angle that's there. I look to the left side and to the right side, and they're straight lines. How did that happen? Did they just send a group of carpenters in here and say, you guys set the pews up any way you want to? Oh, no. The simplicity of design demands a designer. I want you to take that and amplify it from the very fact that the buttons on your shirt, the buttonholes line up exactly with the buttons. Every button is equally spaced the same distance down the front of the shirt that I'm wearing. You know what that says? There must be a designer. All of the lights that are in the auditorium, look at them. They're equally spaced. There are two here and two there. There are those two in that back space. There's one right here in the very middle of the auditorium. Wonder how that happened. You look at all of that there is around. Look at all these windows. Look at the pattern of those of the glass that's in. You think that is a random pattern that is there? I don't know what you do when somebody preaches. Don't you just look up and count how many squares there are in all of these windows here? Do you see the pattern that's in that window? How'd that happen? If that very pattern that's in these stained windows demands somebody made it happen, multiply the universe. God has revealed Himself as the great designer. There's no movement without a mover. Jackie, you've got your walker sitting right here. Guess what? Your walker is not going to move. Jackie, you walked into the building this morning and you put that walker that's there, and it'll be there until Jesus returns, unless there is some outside force that starts the movement of it. A basketball doesn't start bouncing itself. You know, when you're cooking, the spoon doesn't just jump up and start stirring whatever you've been mixing. In the simplest way, where there's movement, there must be the great mover. You know who that designer is? You know who that mover is? I'm not saying he's the God of the Bible. I'm just saying there is a supreme being. There is that prime mover. There is that prime designer. And there is that life giver. Scientifically, get this, science affirms there can be no life unless it comes from life. That's a scientific fact. You know what that means? That means there is an eternal life giver who has given life. Acts chapter 17, verse 28, Paul, talking to the Greeks, to their philosophers, said that he's not far from many of us. As certain of some of your poets have said. And we have the writings, by the way, of Artus and Cleanthes, Greek philosopher who's lived 300 B.C., and Paul quotes them. And do you know what Greek philosophers said? I'm not talking about the Bible. I'm just talking about those Greek philosophers who thought about life, says, in Him we live and move and have our being. He is not far from any of us. There is that one who gives us life. If there ever was a time when there was no life, an eternal living one, there could be no life. Get this point? Evolution demands that which is eternal is matter. Matter does not give life. You know what gives life? Life gives life. Life can use matter and can move and mold matter. But that which is eternal is the eternal living one. Quickly, in the second place, God has revealed Himself in a most ancient book. Have you ever thought about the omniscience of God as manifested in the fact that He has revealed the destiny of nation after nation? Are you aware, and we've emphasized this in some of the Bible classes that we have, that God named a man by the name of Cyrus 200 years before he was ever born and said, and he is the one, he's not alive on this earth, his kingdom is not a powerful kingdom at all at this time, and there will be that king who will arise, here's his name, and he will be the one who writes a decree that was circulated in all the world that says Jerusalem must be rebuilt. And God called that man by name. We have no clue who will be the president in, 6 months from now. God looked at a nation that was a non-existing nation, not totally non-existent, but was an insignificant nation, and says, someday there will be a king, and this is his name, and it'll be 200 years before he does this action, and this is what he will do. All of those prophecies about actions and about kings and about nations. It's not that just one place in the Bible God talks about what's going to happen at this nation. Nation after nation is mentioned. The Moabites, the Ammonites, all these nations. The Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Grecian kingdom. In fact, the Bible shows that before the coming of Jesus, there would be four world kingdoms. It names two of them as the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks. And the one that followed the Greeks was the Roman kingdom. It calls three of those four kingdoms by name, and they're almost non-existent kingdoms whenever Daniel talks about that. How does that come about? Because God has revealed Himself in a book that is unbelievably amazing. Don't put the next slide up yet. You can go ahead and put the eight prophecies about Jesus as one of the great evidences. But let me read to you, and these will be on the screen in a moment. Eight prophecies about Jesus. Prophecy about His birth. The Bible tells that. About the fact there would be a forerunner. About the fact that he would come as a king riding on the colt of a donkey. The Bible talks about that he would be betrayed by a friend and his hands would be wounded. The Bible talks about he would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. Not 29, not 31, 30 pieces of silver. The Bible talks about the fact that those 30 pieces of silver would not only be the betrayal price, but that money would be used to buy a potter's field. The Bible talks about the fact that he would be crucified and his hands and his feet would therefore be pierced. And the Bible talks about that when he is on trial, he would not say anything. What are the odds of that happening? There's a mathematician by the name of Peter Stoner. If you'll go ahead and put that next slide up. He looked at only eight prophecies about Jesus. He says the chance that any man might have fulfilled all eight of these prophecies is 1 in 10 to the 17th power. That would be, and there is that number with the 17 zeros after it, 100 quadrillions for one man to fulfill eight prophecies. Dave, this is an illustration that you used probably a year ago. What does 100 quadrillion look like? If you had 100 quadrillion coins and you spread them out in some place. Well, let's spread them out over Texas. You guys from Texas know how big that state is. 1,000 miles from east to west. I mean, it's just an amazing place. Let's just put 100 quadrillion silver dollars in Texas. That pile of coins would be 2 feet deep. Now we're going to blindfold you in the writings that Stoner gives. He says, put a blind man, and in that 100 quadrillion silver dollars, you put a mark on one of them. And you stir up 100 quadrillions of those coins and mix them all up and turn that blind man loose. Put him in El Paso and let him head east. He'd walk 30 days before he got over to East Texas if he went about 30 miles a day. But he's just walking in one little straight path. Just think of how wide Texas is when you think of it of north to south. And on that trip, he's going to stop one place, north and south, cover every square inch of Texas, and stop one time, one place, and pick up the one coin that has been mixed up in 100 quadrillion. Coins. You know what you'd say? That could never happen. But it did happen in relationship to the 8 prophecies about one man. The odds of one individual's fulfilling, born in a special place. And the actions of his place and the price of his betrayal, every bit of it happened. But that's 8 prophecies. Think of the odds if you get outside of the 8 prophecies. Hugo McCord, in his book, From Heaven or From Men, looks at this and he gives the odds in the other way. He says if there's a 1 in 2 chance of a thing happening, in other words, if there was just one village for Jesus to be born in, one was named Bethlehem, the other was named something else, same number of people were being born at the same, every year, the exact same number, you got a 1 in 2 chance that he'd be in, it's heads or tails. And so McCord takes these same figures and gives it a 50-50 chance. There's not a 50-50 chance about any of the prophecies about Jesus. But if you give it a 50-50 chance, the probability of all of these things being fulfilled is 1,125 million to 1. That's an amazing odd. And then he says, to assume they would happen contemporaneously in the life of one individual, it surpasses the powers of numbers to express those possibilities. He then says, what I've just said about all of those prophecies being fulfilled totally disregards the fact that those prophecies demanded that other people interact, that circumstances change, that there would be those who would be free agents to go against the will of God, and there'd be the passions of the multitude and the ambition of prices for the betrayal money, and all of that. And he says, if 100 prophecies had been made, the chance it would happen to one man is less than all of the drops of water if the world were completely water. Think of the earth. 25,000 miles in diameter, and it's solid water. How many drops are there? The odds of Jesus fulfilling 100 prophecies, allowing a 50-50 chance, is greater than the number of drops in the water if the whole earth were water. You know this. There's not just 100 prophecies. There's not 200. There's 332 prophecies of Christ that are in the Bible. God hath spoken. Hebrews 1 says, in the past He has spoken by the prophets. And that's what we've been looking at. 332 prophecies about Jesus. You know what that says? The only way for those prophecies to exist is for there to be God who knows it all. But the rest of that verse says, He hath in these last days spoken unto us by His Son. Think about the revelation of Jesus in the man of Galilee, the third way God spoken. All of the prophecies, and as amazing and as astounding that God could use simple mortals to bring about the 332 prophecies of the Old Testament, God sent His Son. Did He prove He was the Son? He claimed to be the Son of God over and over again. Anybody could do that. But He proved He was the Son of God by the miracles that He did. Think for just a moment of the difference in the miracles of Jesus and the supposed miracles of televangelists. I think it is amazing what an opportune time it would be for just one televangelist to cure COVID. I don't watch that much religious television, but flipping channels a few weeks ago, they said, oh, remember Brother so-and-so, he's in the hospital and he's got COVID. Physicians, if you have that power, cure that man. And the absence of televangelists is astounding when you look at the fact that every person that was ever brought to the man who says, I am the Son of God, every single one of them was healed, not a single failure. And the ultimate question? He not only claimed to be the Son of God and proved it by the miracles, many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of His disciples that are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe. And the evidence is, He raised Him from the dead. I urge you to take time to read the emphasis of preaching in the New Testament. It's on the resurrection. God has revealed Himself. In the creation, He's revealed Himself in an ancient book, and He's revealed Himself in the personality of Jesus. Have you responded? God has spoken. Have you been listening? Here's the plan of salvation. Believe that He is the Son of God and make up your mind to follow Him. Confess your faith in Him and be immersed that you might be forgiven of your sins. Are you listening to the Creator of the world who says, this is My will for you. I'll save you, add you to the church, and I will someday give you the crown of life if you'll be faithful unto death. If there's sin in your life and you need to deal with it, won't you let it be known by coming to the front right now? As together we stand and sing. Will you come?